from Shroud University. This is Russ Brialde bringing you another podcast on the Shroud of Turin, the greatest mystery in the known world.
Or my colleague who's trying to hope he can get his stuff together for his talk. If he doesn't, we'll just cancel it. Is that a threat? I'm going to speak about further spectroscopic investigation of samples from the Shroud of Turin. These are undertaken for two purposes. They're undertaken to further confirm previous studies that we've carried out, chemical and physical, identifying substances on the Shroud that are involved with the images that we see. And secondly, among the samples that were taken from the sticky tapes for the first part of this, we also had three threads provided from the radiocarbon testing with the permission of Cardinal Ballestrera. And the reason we wanted to test those and compare them is to see if we can answer some of the questions about the radiocarbon dating. The spectroscopic techniques that involved were Fourier transform infrared microspectroscopy. It was carried out with a Spectratech infrared microscope hooked up to a BOMEM spectrometer. The UV visible work on simulacra models of some of the blood types that are in question were done on our Perkin-Elmer continuous recording spectrophotometer, and the SEM work was done on an appropriate microscope over at Texaco. My colleagues and another young physical chemist in the same department of chemistry I'm at, Dr. Russell Selzer, and another good friend of ours, Frank DeBlaise, who's in charge of the vibrational spectroscopy section at Texaco Research, and made access to us to the various infrared spectrometers and to the SEM that we needed. Now, part of the problem in dealing with the radiocarbon data and dealing with it is we have to make a very clear distinction between precision and accuracy. The work that was done by the radiocarbon people can certainly be spoken of as having half-life decent precision. Precision measures how reproducible is a number by different people doing it repetitive number of times, and it fits a Gaussian distribution. But there's another problem when you look at a physical measurement. You can have fantastic precision and still have lousy accuracy. We want to talk about the accuracy of the measurement, because the accuracy tells us how true is the value. And it doesn't fit an ordinary Gaussian distribution. It's actually measured by Poisson distributions. How random is the data? On that basis, you must understand, we cannot talk about the accuracy of the radiocarbon date because they only took one sample. You cannot figure out the shape of a distribution from one point. So right from the very start, we want to find evidence whether or not there's anything to be said about the accuracy of the measurement. We have to understand from the very beginning, you really can't say that the measurement is accurate. Do we have any kinds of evidence that can argue to us that maybe we should have anticipated that, in fact, it is inaccurate? I point out to you, this whole question was discussed at the protocol meeting that set up the radiocarbon dating. I know because I was there. We'd originally agreed that samples would be taken from three geometrically distinct locations on the Shroud, so something could be said about accuracy. That was not done. The site that was chosen is probably one of the worst sites that could have been taken on the Shroud. It's clearly from a water stain area, as you can tell by just looking at it. It also is from a scorched area, which you have to look more carefully at the pattern on the cloth to deduce, but I will show you physical evidence that's from a scorched area. And there is also evidence of reweaving on the edge of this because it was taken from the one of the missing panel pieces below the side sink. And the question arises, is this reweaving just back weaving of shredded cloth? Is it just a selvage edge? Or has there actually been new material rewoven into it? We'll address these kinds of questions. At the STIRP investigation, we did take infrared data. This was done by, without a modern instrument. It was a dispersion instrument, not Fourier transform. There are lots of difficulties with this measurement. One The source for the infrared was of low quality. It was a wide-angle detector, and so, of course, you got some integration of the data. And since we're looking through the humid air of Turin, it's quite a noisy spectrum, so you can't say anything about the background. Nevertheless, this IR data, as lousy as it looks, did allow us to make a number of very simple conclusions analytically. First, it showed the obvious that we really were looking at cellulose. Chemists like to be sure that you're looking at what you think you're looking at. Secondly, we could see that, in fact, the scorch, the burns, the image area all showed evidence of, in fact, oxidation of the cellulose. We could see that the blood areas and the serum areas actually showed evidence for the presence of protein. The typical amide 1-2-3 bands typical of proteins could be seen in the noise. There's no evidence for those in the image, which is a piece of evidence against the painting hypothesis, which suggested that, in fact, collagen or gelatin was there as the binder. And we could see a number of features that suggested it was blood, but unfortunately, they chose the wrong control. They chose whole blood to look at, when further studies have shown they really should have looked at an exudate from a blood clot. First suggested, by the way, at the turn of the century by Paul Vignon. Our later studies have all shown that, in fact, you're really not only looking at an exudate from a blood clot, but an exudate of a blood clot of a man who died a traumatic death. And we'll see the evidence that we're going to look at actually continues to confirm that. There is the infrared spectra of five, it shows four here, but we took five fibers from each of the different three threads from the radiocarbon data. One fiber from each end, one fiber from the middle of the thread, one fiber from the inside of the thread, another fiber at random. And you can see there's a great deal of variability in the pattern. Now, one of the reasons for doing this with a modern instrument is not because we wanted just better spectra. I'm sure those of you who are not chemists don't think it looks any better than the last spectra I showed. But because with a modern instrument, with the computer facilities attached, you have something called spectral analysis programs, which enable us to actually look at a spectrum and one to decide, is there a particular type of functional group or chemical structure present in the structure? If we have a reference background or a reference spectra, we can actually see if material is actually present in the mixture. And the other thing that we can do is we have something called pattern analysis programs that allows us to say whether things fit the same sort of patterns very well, very poorly, or can they be clustered in the patterns. I'm going to show you the outer warp thread, which is the thread on the outside of the sample that was cut, an inner warp thread on the inside part where the fiber, the sample was cut, and a weft thread. It was taken from the portion that was reserved beyond the piece from the samples that were taken out. And the first thing to say, you're going to see that all of these spectra are very variable. And it's quite remarkable because these are samples from an area that was less than a few square centimeters. And I'm going to show you rather quickly, in fact, we could separate these with the cluster analysis into five separate distinct patterns. And that tells us there's a great deal of variability in the chemical composition of the radiocarbon sample. Here's the first set. You can see they look quite variable. Here's the second set. They not only look quite variable, but they look different from the ones you just saw at the last one. Don't worry, in the end, I'll show you a summary slide that shows the patterns are different. Here's the weft thread, and it looks entirely different from the two warp threads. Again, in a variable set of patterns. You see the variations there in the low frequency end. Here are four of the non-image threads that were taken from the sticky tapes. Now we use the same technique we use in the chemical studies. You know, the talk, hey, it's a Fourier instrument, you can take it through the tape, through the glass, and subtract it out. You end up with noise. So the fibers had to be cut out, and as we found in the previous studies, once you cut it out and cleaned it, you had to check that you got what you got by fluorescence microscopy, reflection spectroscopy, polarization spectroscopy, and phase contrast spectroscopy to make sure that this, for example, was non-image and not image. These were four fibers. They were transferred to the salt plates that are used with the FTIR microscope, And you can see the patterns are in fact quite similar. These fibers, this one came from the head area, the chest area, the knee area, and the foot area. So here's four fibers taken over 2 meters of length of the cloth that in fact give in fact one pattern. Later I will summarize what we know about these. These do not show as much oxidation as the fibers from the burn, scorch, and image fibers, though. We're going to be interested in the amount of oxidation in this carbonyl region. And there are very distinct different types of carbonyl bands in this region. We're also going to be interested in seeing if we see any evidence for amides in here, for evidence where proteins are and are not. All right. These show the smallest extent of oxidation of any of the fibers we looked at, even less than what was evidenced in the radiocarbon fibers. There is one feature to point out, however. There is an enhanced methyl carboxyl, methyl ester absorption here as compared with ordinary linen. That does tend to confirm the identification made a year ago at Nice by Stephen Motin that the fluorescence in the background of this cloth may be due to the presence of pectic substances. We're going to follow that up. Here are the water stains. And again, they show a fairly uniform pattern. And the distinctive feature of these patterns is it shows a great deal of carboxylate absorption rather than that is the ionized form of the carboxyl group, which indicates there's the presence possibly of a lot of salts in here. And this is confirmed by the appearance of these in the polarizing microscope. And as I'll show you later, it's also confirmed by the SEM data. Quartz shows a very pronounced oxidation pattern. And in this is the least scorched, middle scorched, and the highest scorched. You can see a definite transition from aldehyde carbonyls to carboxyl carbonyls. But the conjugated carbonyl absorption is quite low. And it's a conjugated carbonyl absorption that in the past we've identified is typical, in fact, of the image chemistry. It's important to note that we can actually distinguish between a scorch and the image. Please note, even though the spectral features change, they are the same pattern. Unfortunately, those tapes have been really picked over, and we could only find two image fibers left that could be tested and looked at. And you can see that, in fact, the pattern fits a pattern, but it's difficult to talk about a cluster with only two in the sample. But it could be shown that where their characteristics clustered, they were quite distinct from the other fibers, and certainly distinct from the regions where we clustered the data for the radiocarbon. The thing that's interesting here is this very pronounced conjugated carbonyl absorption in these, confirming the chemical analysis of the structure of the chromophore being a direct dehydrate of oxidation of the linen and showing conjugated carbonyl absorption. The backing cloth is here, and only I can tell you is we could prove it was not the same kind of linen that we found on the shroud, a distinctly different composition, which we know was actually bleached by a very different technique. Here's one of the serum-coated fibers, and the thing that's distinctive about this is, one, in this region can clearly detect the amide 1,2,3 groups typical of proteins. Those absorptions were lacking in the previous fibers. They were not also found, incidentally, in the radiocarbon fibers, so any suggestions there's secondary amides responsible for some of the problems in the radiocarbon dating data are in fact not validated by the IR. This clearly supports the idea that there is a protein here and not in the image fiber as required by the painting hypothesis. Also managed to find two more of the blood globs, and they gave these spectra, which has some distinctive features, and we took great advantage of the spectral analysis program, as I'll show you shortly in this. And this shows you something about the reproducibility of the spectra, because these first two spectra are on the same glob. What we did using the apertures, the knife edge apertures in the instrument, is to first take a spectrum of one side of the glob and then move the aperture to take the other half of the glob. And it shows you that the technique we worked out for dealing with the problem that we're dealing with a microscope and a spectrometer at the same time, which is not trivial, was in fact surmounted by the standard procedure we use for taking these spectra and getting repeatable spectra. we're interested in, does in fact that blood glob show the features of in fact blood that you would expect from the exudate of a clot of a man who died a traumatic death. That means you expect to be able to find hemoglobin in it. It should show spectral similarities to dried whole blood. And if a man dies a traumatic death, a lot of his blood under those conditions where it's released from the red blood cell will in fact be converted to bilirubin. He'll become jaundiced. We're very surprised to find out we made a mixture of bilirubin, protein, and hemoglobin to make a simulated clot. And you'll say, hey, that really doesn't look much like the ones you showed us on the previous slide. And that's because we added twice too much protein and only about a third of the amount of bilirubin we should have added to it. There's an enormous amount of bilirubin in these samples. And in fact, it's the reason why the blood under the microscope still looks red. You all know, you've heard it from lots of people, old blood should look brown. But if you take brown and you mix it with an orangey-red material, which is what bilirubin-bound protein looks like, you get something that looks red. We've established that by chemistry. We've established it from the UV spectra, which I'll also show you better spectra on this. And now we've also supported it by the infrared. You can actually show that bilirubin is contained in this, and it's contained in the blood globs I just showed you in the previous slide. We can show the hemoglobin is there. We can show the basic features of dried blood are there. On the other hand, if you think that that blood there is a mixture of iron oxide, mercuric sulfide with a trace of calcite in a collagen binder, it doesn't fit. You can show that those materials are not there, but I might point out that it's sort of unfair because the extinction for iron oxide, mercuric sulfide, in fact, is very low. You're really looking at the noise. However, if you insist that the calcite is there, this is a crystal, and it has very sharp infrared bands, and you can see some of the peaks in here. They're distinctly missing in the blood glob. So if you insist your mineral blood has calcite in it, you're in trouble because it doesn't match what we see on the shroud. I promise you, there's one busy slide with all the patterns. The only thing you're supposed to do is nod and say, yes, clearly they all look like they're different spectra, which proves they have different chemical composition. So we've already made part of our point. The radiocarbon fibers have a different chemical composition from the non-image fibers of the body of the cloth. Therefore, you have a right to raise the question, is this a representative sample? Doesn't matter whether you think you know an answer to this or not, it's not a representative sample. Therefore, you not only have the problem you only took one sample, but you have a non-representative sample, and therefore you can't speak about the accuracy. Here's the comparison of the blood globs, the germ fiber, and the two simulations. And again, you can see if we play with a spectral analysis program, we can show that the real blood sample we took can be matched by the simulated sample, but the mineral sample does not. I've got the spectra in front of me on the page. Since we had the two simulated blood samples, we decided to go back and check them against the UV visible data that's done previously on the shroud. This was the direct reflection spectra taken by Sam Pellicori, and actually it's been a little bit manipulated. It's been Kabelka monked to try to get rid of part of the background reflection. This was the original microspectrophotometric spectrum that John Heller and I did in Joe Gall's lab at Yale. And it shows the typical peaks associated with a heme protein. And there's a very interesting peak at 450 here, a shoulder which shows up in two, which we identified is due to protein-bound bilirubin. There's an enormous amount of bilirubin there. Normally, you wouldn't see this. And there's a peak in the reflection data out here, again, can be associated with biliproteins and in particular bilirubin and perhaps a trace of biliverdin. I should point out that peak is distinctive of species. When the bilirubin is in fact formed, bilirubin has a double bond and it exists in two geometrical conformational forms, an E form and a Z form. These can in fact have different degrees of aggregating, and when they bind with albumin in the blood, because the body wants to get rid of them, those conformational forms in the different proteins are forced to relax, and the position of that peak varies with the species dependent on the protein it's bound to. There is someone who said, oh, well, they used fish bile all the time in making medieval paintings. The position for the bilirubin protein thing in fish bile is removed by 15 nanometers from the peak where we see it, which is dead on for primate bilirubin-bound protein-bound bilirubins. Whether or not you want to think of that as being pongid instead of human is your choice. Here is the new spectra we took. And you see the clapboard makes a good match, except the bilirubin peak is too low. We didn't have the simulator here, so I can't tell you if we threw three times as much in, it would look better. But clearly, if we threw three times as much in, it would be up here somewhere, which is a match to the previous spectra. On the other hand, the mineral ones don't absorb in the lines we see in the whole cloth or in fact, the micro sample we took at all. So the UV makes it clear there is no iron oxide, no mercuric sulfide present in these blood globs. None of the SEM data shows there's a mess of stuff there like SEM data usually does. The trouble with SEM data, you're looking at the surface of these things and you see all the dirt that's there. There's two things to say about it. One, there's evidence of all sorts of strange things there, like gold, for example, here in the third row. Why should there be gold there? We actually saw particles of gold and particles of salts. They can be identified when you look in the microscope, not only by the structural form, but by these things that you read out. I point out to you, some of these have been used as evidence that an artist painted it and he left his pigments there. Father Fassati pointed out a number of years ago that, in fact, there are some 48 known copies of the shroud that have been sanctified by having the painted image pressed against the original. There's a name for this in forensics, it's called contact transfer. We've pointed it out many times, and my colleague is Isabel in the back. She did something that the artists, that our scientists were too stupid to do. She actually tested it. And in fact, there is contact transfer. This is called Locard's principle, by the way, in forensics. The perp and the victim have to transfer trace evidence from one to the other. Here's some proof of it. And it's proof of the fact that all these strange things people see, the adventitious materials in the shroud, are only true that's been in the presence of an artist, not that an artist painted it. The other thing, I've re-summarized some of it. Given what we turn the saltier elements to a chemist, and you see there's far more salt here in the radiocarbon fibers than even in the water stain. And that's because in the water stain, when the water hit it, and these soluble salts started diffusing out into the cloth, they diffuse without limit until they stop diffusing. But if you look where the sample was taken, it's a bounded water stain. So all of these soluble materials diffuse till they hit that edge, and then they concentrate there. Here's proof of the fact that it's a water stain. And in fact, if we then go back and try and compound the spectra, we find out that, in fact, the radiocarbon sample, the patterns, the cluster patterns, intersect that of the water stains in the scorch. So in fact, we're quite justified in saying, hey, that sample was taken from a water stain scorched area. All right, let me summarize what we think we've done here. We've confirmed again that the blood corresponds to the type of blood we previously talked about found on a shroud. It's an exudate from a clot from a man who died a traumatic death. It is not matched by a mineral simulation. We've then shown that the chromophore that makes up the image on a shroud is in fact a dehydrated, oxidized form of the cellulose structure, where the major chromophore is a conjugated carbonyl, as we've said previously. We've shown that the radiocarbon fibers are in fact distinctly different from the non-image fibers of the body of the cloth, and therefore we're justified in saying that you really have no measure of accuracy. However, we could only say you can't claim it's accurate. I'd like to show you the evidence that it is not accurate. And I'm going to repeat what my colleague, Dr. Weiner, showed you earlier this morning. This is the dorsal blood wounds on the back of the head of the Shroud of Turin. This is a set of blood wounds found on the cloth of Oviedo. You can see the patterns are clearly similar. They're not dots. And in fact, we can even tell which of these patterns went on first because the margins on the cloth of AOVADO ones are actually heavier than the margins on the shroud ones, which means they weren't as clotted and more blood could be transferred to the cloth. Alan talked to you about doing degrees of congruence. Us chemists are lazy. I did something else. I beat up my son as a computer expert. He took a morph program. The morph program he has brings two images to congruence in steps of 5%. Three steps were enough to make these two sets of images completely superimposable, which means these images are congruent to the order of 85 to 90%. That's not coincidence. They're not a simple pattern. There's evidence that both are blood. Stop and think about it. That means they had to imprint these two pieces of cloth within the same 2-hour period. Since we can trace the cloth of Oviedo to approximately the 7th century, it tells us that we don't care what you claim about the precision of the radiocarbon date. It is inaccurate, and it must be at least as old as the 7th century. Thank you.
From Shroud University, this is Russ Brialt. I hope you've enjoyed today's podcast, and we hope you stop back from time to time and see what else is new. Also, check out Shroud University itself with all kinds of videos, audios, video blogs, and pretty much everything you can think of related to the Shroud of Turin, the greatest mystery in the known world.